The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
Critically important. Why? Just because you lose muscle or muscle-related indices, let me correct myself, doesn't necessarily mean you're losing strength or performance.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine, in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call is based on an article titled Effective Incretin-Based and Non-Pharmacologic Weight Loss on Body Composition, a Systematic Review. Joining us on the podcast is the first author, John A. Batsis, who's a geriatrician and clinical researcher focusing primarily on aging, obesity, sarcopenia, physical functioning, and healthier aging in older adults. We hope that you learn quite a bit during this podcast. John, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I really enjoyed listening to you and meeting you at the ACP annual meeting and found your study fascinating and important and really want to know what happens next. But let's talk about your study. And I came into that talk knowing that you lost muscle mass with GLP-1s. Now I don't really know whether you really lost muscle function or not. What did you find in your study? And what I love about it, it's not just GLP-1s, but you compared it to other weight loss.
Yeah, no, and thank you very much for the opportunity to share, you know, some insights beyond my presentation at ACP. I've been thinking about this topic for years now, and I think we really need to think about, I think a major take-home point here is not only the quantitative findings or the qualitative findings, but really about weight loss includes both muscle, includes fat, and it occurs irrespective of the modality that you're using. And I think that's a major reason why we included the lifestyle interventions, is to demonstrate to the readers and to the community that this is not just GLP-1 GIP centric. This is all about weight. When you lose weight, you lose different compartments, and the extent to which you lose may differ depending on the amount of weight that you lose. So I think that's a key take-home point that we've heard this over the last couple of years with the emergence of these medicines. Oh, GLP-1, you lose a lot of muscle. Well, you lose it muscle and muscle-related compartments when you lose weight. We know that. That's been proven in lifestyle-based studies. So I think that's really important for not only the reader, but our lay community to be aware of.
So the big message at the beginning is that if you're going to lose weight, you're going to lose the measurement of muscle. So let's talk about that, because that's really what I find fascinating, is use the term muscle-related indices. I really like that. Maybe it's the academic in me that likes this complicated verbiage. So talk about the difference between muscle-related indices and actual muscle, and whether we're fooling ourselves in how we measure the decrease of muscle.
Great point. So I won't lie to you and to the audience. We struggled as authors in terms of how do we communicate this to our readers. And we're being really meticulous about our terminology. And you may get 10 different scientists or clinicians, and they may use different terminology. But let me take a step back. Measuring muscle, the only way you can actually measure true muscle is using gold standard measures of CT, computed tomography, or magnetic resonance imaging using MRI, period. There are other experimental research-based methods. Deuterated D3 creatine has been used in research studies, but to measure muscle itself, those are the only two gold standard techniques. Here's where things get really interesting, is when you look at studies, and we're looking at studies, not only the lifestyle-based studies, but GLP-1 based studies, they're using different measurement modalities. And I think this is something that is overlooked. When you look at other meta-analyses or systematic reviews, individual authors are combining these modalities of bioelectrical impedance, DEXA, dual X-ray absorptiometry, CT and MRI. That's a problem. You're basically combining apples and oranges together, and you can't do that. So in our study, we use the term muscle-related indices, and we use different cut points, and we can kind of get to that in a little bit, based on the different modalities we're using. So DEXA measures fat-free mass. Well, some DEXA studies measure that includes both muscle-related indices, bone, and lean soft tissue. Others just measure lean soft tissue. So individual authors aren't clear in terms of what the actual measurement is, and hence using the term muscle-related indices. So there are recent studies that show, well, GLP-1s only lo you lose 15%. Well, that's using muscle, and that may be appropriate or inappropriate using gold standard measures versus DEXA. Generally, fat-free mass, if you look at it as a compartment, ab about, and I'm using that very crudely, non-scientific, non-precise, about half of fat-free mass is that of muscle. But you can't measure muscle with DEXA, for instance, or with bioelectrical impedance.
So this gets even more interesting and more confusing. So we don't know whether people lose strength.
Great. I'm so glad you brought that up. And this is something that we looked in our study. We looked at amongst all the studies, no one measured objective strength. And I really want to be very particular here. There are some studies that looked at subjective physical function using validated measures, SF-36, PROMIS scores. But objective is very different than subjective. Objective measures of strength, grip strength, knee extensor strength, performance measures, sit to stand, time to get up and go, 6-minute walk. We didn't find in our studies that we evaluated anyone that looked at objective physical function and performance measures. Critically important, why? Just because you lose muscle or muscle-related indices, let me correct myself, doesn't necessarily mean you're losing strength or performance. And a testament to that, and this has been proven in lifestyle studies, particularly in older adults. I want to reference a study by one of my friend and colleague, Dennis Villarreal, who evaluated lifestyle interventions in older adults with obesity and frailty. They lost fat, lean, soft tissue in their study, but their performance, their objective physical performance improved. So just because you lose muscle-related indices doesn't necessarily mean you're losing strength or performance. They're related, but in some people, and it depends on what you're losing. We hypothesize it's because you're losing the fat that's in the muscle, but we need further studies to better evaluate that.
So most of my friends are over 65 because I'm an old person, and a lot of them have been on GLP-1s of various types, but the study didn't focus on that age group. So how do we can we relate what the trials did with what's going to happen when you're 70 and you take a GLP-1 or 75 or whatever?
And this is an ongoing issue with evaluating older adults. So I'm a little biased because I'm a geriatrician by training. So, most of my work is really focused on older adults. But a lot of trials exclude older adults. And even in the GLP-1 world, when you look at the trials, some of the earlier formative foundational studies had about 6% maybe 10% of their cohort over the age of 65, and really very, very few over the age of 75. There are very few studies I can count on probably one hand that actually evaluate individuals whose where the study cohort's mean age is 65 and above. So that's really important because you're extrapolating data and you're evaluating data on a different population and saying, well, it's the same, they're just older patients. So we need to be really careful when we extrapolate data because older adults have different biology, different physiology. In our own study, we looked at the median age, and the median age ranged in the low 20s to low 60s. So very few of the studies that we evaluated were in older adults. We need more studies. I say that I'm a little biased, but really, this is an important population and a population that is the most rapidly growing population that's being prescribed these medications.
I think that most people have heard that you get a decrease in muscle when you go on a GLP-1 and lose weight. I've been asked this question when they're getting ready to start, and I wasn't very smart about it. So I want to become smart. If you had a friend who's starting a GLP-1, what would you hope their doctor would tell them based upon this information? And then after that, let's talk about what study needs to be done.
You
Because
got it.
let's do the, as a physician, what should I be telling my patients? As a friend, what should I be telling my friends?
So my approach is what I counsel patients, it's an individualized approach, but what I counsel patients is what I would tell my friends. It's almost like this is what I would tell my family member if they were to go on a GLP-1. My approach, and I'm much more cautious in the patients that I prescribe that are older adults. I evaluate them. I make sure that I'm not just writing a prescription and off they go and I'll see them a couple of months later. I need to make sure this is a team-based approach, and we need to move away from a physician or an associate provider-centric approach and really a team-based approach where I have a conversation as their PCP and say, help me understand what you're eating, your dietary patterns. And I have them see a dietitian. They may say, well, do I really need to see a dietitian? I say, yes, you need to see a dietitian. Why? Because we want to make sure they're both their macro and micronutrient kind of composition is going to be maintained. And in particular, their protein supplementation and vitamin D is maintained and augmented during the GLP-1. We need studies on that. We'll come back to that. But having a registered dietitian nutritionist work with the patient before they start on a GLP-1. Get those low-hanging fruit off the table. And in tandem, have them engage in different types of exercise-based activity. Now, when we think about exercise, it's not a one-size-fits-all. We think of broadly aerobic resistance. Aerobic exercise, we know, will improve cardiopulmonary and cardiovascular function, but its resistant exercise will help mitigate loss of muscle mass and help improve muscle strength. So, in my patients, I ask them, tell me the type of physical activity you're doing, like an exercise you're doing. If they say, well, I'm not doing any, I'm not going to the gym, I'm not lifting weights, I'm not using resistant exercise bands, I say, you know what, before we actually prescribe these meds, let's have you engage in this. And let's have, in an ideal utopian world, I would have a care manager or a community health worker help monitor this at home to make sure that they're doing this. Why? Because you get them in a pattern, it's a behavioral change. And once they're on that and they get into a regular pattern, then we start saying, okay, now is a good time. So the ideal patient is the one that has a great diet, is exercising. We start them on a GLP-1. And I generally, in my old, particularly my older adult population, I have them, because their tolerability issues at all ages, but increasingly as one ages, I have them come back at 6 to 8 weeks. I don't do the standard ramp up that I see that is in the package insert. Start low, go slow. That's in one step at a time.
That all makes a lot of sense. And those are the types of things that I've been saying. I like to hear you say it because now I'm going to steal from that. What studies do you want to see?
We have a lack of studies that incorporate really proper, structured, multi-component interventions as adjuncts to GLP-1s. We can't just, and the studies that have been performed using GLP-1s, when you really dissect the behavioral interventions, the lifestyle, the dietary, the exercise, they're all over the place. So what we need to know, both from an efficacy standpoint and then an effectiveness standpoint, different trials, efficacy, does it work? Does it improve function? Does it improve quality of life with structured adjuncts? In the real world is different. We know that from lifestyle-based weight loss interventions. How do we engage community partners? That's a major gap, I think, in the literature. And how do we engage our healthcare system to connect? You can't do everything in an office setting, and you shouldn't probably do everything in an office setting. We're a spoke of the wheel, and we need to involve other spokes of the wheel for the patient to get involved.
So let me see if I have this right. The GLP-1s and the GLP-1 more complicated ones like tirzepatide, I forgot how to say
Tirzepatide, yep.
tirzepatide, and the new ones that are coming out
Yep.
are going to lead to a lot of weight loss, but taking care of people who have a need for that for weight loss is more than just giving them a pill. And so that we need to say, well, the pill's going to help you, but you still have to do other stuff to stay healthy. And I really like that you ramp up slowly because I have seen quite a few people who've had significant GI problems from going up too fast. And that can lead to other serious problems that I've mentioned before on this podcast, including a recent patient who developed severe thiamine deficiency from the nausea and vomiting of GLP-1. So they're wonderful drugs, but they're a little scary. So what's the biggest thing you want your colleagues to hear from this talk?
I think the biggest thing is I think we need to treat the patient, don't treat the number. And I think that's really important. Obesity is a chronic disease, it's heterogeneous. As one ages, heterogeneity increases. So treating patient X is different than treating patient Y. You move away from a weight. I personally feel we need to move away from a weight-centric approach to more of a function quality of life-centric approach. There are some of these newer medications that are going to be, either FDA approved or will be FDA approved, will lead to precipitous amounts of weight loss. For some, they may need it to have metabolic improvements. But if you're going from say a BMI of 30, 32 to a BMI of 23, that may be problematic. We don't have data. We speculate here, but we don't, but that worries me. So just because you can achieve a given amount of weight loss doesn't mean you should achieve a certain amount of weight loss.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and for making us much more sophisticated on this very important group of drugs, what they do, and what we don't know yet.
Well, again, a pleasure, and thank you very much for the opportunity to kind of share some of our work and the topic itself. It's because it's not going away.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. The most important thing to get out of this paper is that while the imaging of muscle mass looks as if we lose muscle mass when we take GLP-1s, however, there's no objective strength or performance data to prove that it's actually muscle and not the fat within the muscle. As of right now, we're not sure about that because there are no good studies. The weakness that is pointed out in this study is there are not a lot of data in patients over 65, and many of the people who are taking GLP-1s are over 65. Dr. Batsis made it very clear that when he takes care of patients who are going to be on GLP-1s, he always has them work with a dietitian first. He wants to get them on a healthy diet and exercise program before they start a GLP-1. We hope that this discussion is helpful to you in your practice, and we really thank you for listening to our podcast.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall